We Can Remember It For You Wholesale by Philip K. Dick. Part 1. He awoke and wanted Mars. The valleys, he thought. What would it be like to trudge among them? Great and greater yet, the dream grew as he became fully conscious. The dream and the yearning. He could almost feel the enveloping presence of the other world, which only government agents and high officials had seen. A clerk like himself? Not likely. "Are you getting up or not?" his wife Kirsten asked drowsily, with her usual hint of fierce crossness. "If you are, push the hot coffee button on the darn stove." "Okay," Douglas Quayle said, and made his way barefoot from the bedroom of their Connaught to the kitchen. There, having dutifully pressed the hot coffee button, he seated himself at the kitchen table, brought out a yellow small tin of fine Dean Swift snuff. He inhaled briskly, and the Beau Nash mixture stung his nose, burned the roof of his mouth, but still he inhaled. It woke him up, and allowed his dreams, his nocturnal desires and random wishes, to condense into a semblance of rationality. "I will go," he said to himself. "Before I die, I'll see Mars." It was, of course, impossible, and he knew this even as he dreamed. But the daylight, the mundane noise of his wife now brushing her hair before the bedroom mirror, everything conspired to remind him of what he was. A miserable little salaried employee, he said to himself with bitterness. Kirsten reminded him of this at least once a day, and he did not blame her. It was a wife's job to bring her husband down to earth. Down to earth, he thought, and laughed. The figure of speech in this was literally apt. "What are you sniggering about?" his wife asked as she swept into the kitchen, her long, busy pink robe wagging after her. "A dream, I bet. You're always full of them." "Yes," he said, and gazed out the kitchen window at the hover cars and traffic runnels and all the little energetic people hurrying to work. In a little while he would be among them, as always. "I bet it had to do with some woman," Kirsten said witheringly. "No," he said. "A god. The god of war. He has wonderful craters with every kind of plant life growing deep down in them." "Listen." Kirsten crouched down beside him and spoke earnestly, the harsh quality momentarily gone from her voice. "The bottom of the ocean, our ocean, is much more, an infinity of times more beautiful. You know that. Everyone knows that. Rent an artificial gill outfit for both of us. Take a week off from work, and we can descend and live down there at one of those year-round aquatic resorts. And in addition—" she broke off. "You're not listening. You should be. Here is something a lot better than that compulsion, that obsession you have about Mars, and you don't even listen." Her voice rose piercingly. "God in heaven, you're doomed, Doug. What's going to become of you?"
"I'm going to work," he said, rising to his feet, his breakfast forgotten. "That's what's going to become of me."
She eyed him. "You're getting worse. More fanatical every day. Where is it going to lead?"
"To Mars," he said, and opened the door to the closet to get down a fresh shirt to wear to work. Having descended from the taxi, Douglas Quayle slowly walked across three densely populated foot runnels and to the modern, attractively inviting doorway. There he halted, impeding mid-morning traffic, and with caution read the shifting color neon sign. He had, in the past, scrutinized this sign before, but never had he come so close. This was very different. What he did now was something else. Something which, sooner or later, had to happen. Recal Incorporated. Was this the answer? After all, an illusion, no matter how convincing, remained nothing more than an illusion. At least objectively. But subjectively, quite the opposite entirely. And anyhow, he had an appointment within the next 5 minutes. Taking a deep breath of mildly smog-infested Chicago air, he walked through the dazzling polychromatic shimmer of the doorway and up to the receptionist's counter. The nicely articulated blonde at the counter, bare-bosomed and tidy, said pleasantly,
"Good morning, Mr. Quayle."
"Yes," he said. "I'm here to see about a recal course, as I guess you know."
"Not recal, but recall," the receptionist corrected him. She picked up the receiver of the vidphone by her smooth elbow and said into it, "Mr. Douglas Quayle is here, Mr. McLean. May he come inside now, or is it too soon?"
"There's a wum-wum-wop,"
the phone mumbled.
"Yes, Mr. Quayle," she said. "You may go in. Mr. McLean is expecting you."
As he started off uncertainly, she called after him,
"Room D, Mr. Quayle, to your right."
After a frustrating but brief moment of being lost, he found the proper room. The door hung open, and inside, at a big, genuine walnut desk, sat a genial-looking man, middle-aged, wearing the latest Martian frog-pelt gray suit. His attire alone would have told Quayle that he had come to the right person.
"Sit down, Douglas,"
McLean said, waving his plump hand toward a chair which faced the desk.
"So you want to have gone to Mars. Very good."
Quayle seated himself, feeling tense. "I'm not so sure this is worth the fee," he said. "It costs a lot, and as far as I can see, I really get nothing." "Costs almost as much as going," he thought.
"You get tangible proof of your trip," McLean disagreed emphatically. "All the proof you'll need. Here, I'll show you."
He dug within a drawer of his impressive desk.
"Ticket stub."
Reaching into a manila folder, he produced a small square of embossed cardboard.
"It proves you went and returned. Postcards."
He laid out four franked picture 3D full-color postcards in a neatly arranged row on the desk for Quayle to see.
"Film. Shots you took of local sites on Mars with a rented moving camera."
To Quayle he displayed those too.
"Plus the names of people you met, 200 poscreds worth of souvenirs, which will arrive from Mars within the following month, and passport, certificates listing the shots you received, and more."
He glanced up keenly at Quayle.
"You'll know you went, all right," he said. "You won't remember us, won't remember me, or ever having been here. It'll be a real trip in your mind. We guarantee that. A full 2 weeks of recall, every last piddling detail. Remember this, if at any time you doubt that you really took an extensive trip to Mars, you can return here and get a full refund. You see?"
"But I didn't go," Quayle said. "I won't have gone, no matter what proofs you provide me with." He took a deep, unsteady breath. "And I never was a secret agent with Interplan." It seemed impossible to him that Recall Incorporated's extra-factual memory implant would do its job, despite what he had heard people say.
"Mr. Quayle," McLean said patiently, "as you explained in your letter to us, you have no chance, no possibility in the slightest of ever actually getting to Mars. You can't afford it. And what is much more important, you could never qualify as an undercover agent for Interplan or anybody else. This is the only way you can achieve your lifelong dream. Am I not correct, sir?" You can't be this. You can't actually do this, he chuckled. But you can have been and have done. We see to that, and our fee is reasonable. No hidden charges, he smiled encouragingly.
Is an extra-factual memory that convincing? Quail asked.
More than the real thing, sir. Had you really gone to Mars as an interplan agent, you would by now have forgotten a great deal. Our analysis of true MEM systems, authentic recollections of major events in a person's life, shows that a variety of details are very quickly lost to the person. Forever. Part of the package we offer you is such deep implantation of recall that nothing is forgotten. The packet which is fed to you while you're comatose is the creation of trained experts, men who have spent years on Mars. In every case, we verify details down to the last iota. And you've picked a rather easy extra-factual system. Had you picked Pluto, or wanted to be Emperor of the Inner Planet Alliance, we'd have much more difficulty, and the charges would be considerably greater.
Reaching into his coat for his wallet, Quail said, Okay, it's been my lifelong ambition, and so I see I'll never really do it, so I guess I'll have to settle for this.
Don't think of it that way, McLean said severely. You're not accepting second best, the actual memory, with all its vagueness, omissions, and ellipses, not to say distortions. That's second best.
He accepted the money and pressed a button on his desk.
All right, Mr. Quail, he said, as the door of his office opened and two burly men swiftly entered. You're on your way to Mars as a secret agent.
He rose, came over to shake Quail's nervous, moist hand.
Or rather, you have been on your way. This afternoon at 4:30, you will, arrive back here on Terra. A cab will leave you off at your Conep, and as I say, you will never remember seeing me or coming here. You won't, in fact, even remember having heard of our existence.
His mouth dry with nervousness, Quail followed the two technicians from the office. What happened next depended on them.
Will I actually believe I've been on Mars? He wondered. That I managed to fulfill my lifetime ambition?
He had a strange lingering intuition that something would go wrong. But just what, he did not know. He would have to wait and find out. The intercom on McLean's desk, which connected him with the work area of the firm, buzzed, and a voice said,
Mr. Quail is under sedation now, sir. Do you want to supervise this one, or shall we go ahead?
It's routine, McLean observed. You may go ahead, Lowe. I don't think you'll run into any trouble.
Programming an artificial memory of a trip to another planet, with or without the added fillip of being a secret agent, showed up on the firm's work schedule with monotonous regularity. In 1 month, he calculated wryly, we must do 20 of these. Ersatz interplanetary travel has become our bread and butter.
Whatever you say, Mr. McLean,
Lowe's voice came, and thereupon the intercom shut off. Going to the vault section in the chamber behind his office, McLean searched about for a 3-packet, trip to Mars, and a 62-packet, secret interplan spy. Finding the 2 packets, he returned with them to his desk, seated himself comfortably, poured out the contents. Merchandise which would be planted in Quail's Conapt while the lab technicians busied themselves installing false memory. A 1 Poscred Sneaky Pete sidearm, McLean reflected. That's the largest item. Sets us back financially the most. Then a pellet-sized transmitter, which could be swallowed if the agent were caught. Code book that astonishingly resembled the real thing. The firm's models were highly accurate, based, whenever possible, on actual U.S. military issue. Odd bits which made no intrinsic sense, but which would be woven into the warp and woof of Quail's imaginary trip.
would coincide with his memory. Half an ancient silver 50-cent piece, several quotations from John Donne's sermons written incorrectly, each on a separate piece of transparent tissue-thin paper, several match folders from bars on Mars, a stainless steel spoon engraved property of Dome, Mars National Kibbutzim, a wire-tapping coil which... The intercom buzzed.
Mr. McLean, I'm sorry to bother you, but something rather ominous has come up. Maybe it would be better if you were in here after all. Quayle is already under sedation. He reacted well to the narcodrine. He's completely unconscious and receptive, but...
I'll be in. Sensing trouble, McLean left his office. A moment later, he emerged in the work area. On a hygienic bed lay Douglas Quayle, breathing slowly and regularly, his eyes virtually shut. He seemed dimly, but only dimly, aware of the two technicians, and now McLean himself.
"There's no space to insert false memory patterns." McLean felt irritation. "Merely drop out 2 work weeks. He's employed as a clerk at the West Coast Emigration Bureau, which is a government agency, so he undoubtedly has or had 2 weeks' vacation within the last year. That ought to do it."
Petty details annoyed him, and always would.
"Our problem," Lowe said sharply, "is something quite different."
He bent over the bed, said to Quayle,
"Tell Mr. McLean what you told us."
To McLean, he said,
"Listen closely."
The gray-green eyes of the man lying supine in the bed focused on McLean's face. The eyes, he observed uneasily, had become hard. They had a polished, inorganic quality, like semi-precious tumbled stones. He was not sure that he liked what he saw. The brilliance was too cold.
"What do you want now?" Quayle said harshly. "You've broken my cover. Get out of here before I take you all apart."
He studied McLean.
"Especially you," he continued. "You're in charge of this counter-operation."
Lowe said,
"How long were you on Mars?"
"1 month," Quayle said gratingly.
"And your purpose there?"
Lowe demanded. The meager lips twisted. Quayle eyed him and did not speak. At last, drawling the words out so that they dripped with hostility, he said,
"Agent for Interplan, as I already told you. Don't you record everything that's said? Play your vid-aud tape back for your boss and leave me alone."
He shut his eyes then. The hard brilliance ceased. McLean felt instantly a rushing splurge of relief. Lowe said quietly,
"This is a tough man, Mr. McLean."
"He won't be," McLean said, "after we arrange for him to lose his memory chain again. He'll be as meek as before."
To Quayle he said,
"So this is why you wanted to go to Mars so terribly bad."
Without opening his eyes, Quayle said,
"I never wanted to go to Mars. I was assigned it. They handed it to me, and there I was, stuck. Oh, yeah, I admit I was curious about it. Who wouldn't be?"
Again he opened his eyes and surveyed the three of them, McLean in particular.
"Quite a truth drug you've got here. It brought up things I had absolutely no memory of." He pondered. "I wonder about Kirsten," he said, half to himself. "Could she be in on it? An Interplan contact keeping an eye on me to be certain I didn't regain my memory? No wonder she's been so derisive about my wanting to go there."
Faintly, he smiled. The smile, one of understanding, disappeared almost at once. McLean said,
"Please believe me, Mr. Quayle, we stumbled onto this entirely by accident. In the work we do..."
"I believe you,"
Quayle said. He seemed tired now. The drug was continuing to pull him under deeper and deeper.
"Where did I say I'd been?" he murmured. "Mars? Hard to remember. I know I'd like to see it. So would everybody else. But me..."
His voice trailed off.
"Just a clerk. And nothing. Clerk.
Straightening up, Lowe said to his superior,
"He wants a false memory implanted that corresponds to a trip he actually took, and a false reason which is the real reason. He's telling the truth. He's a long way down in the narcodrine. The trip is very vivid in his mind, at least under sedation, but apparently he doesn't recall it otherwise. Someone, probably at a government military sciences lab, erased his conscious memories. All he knew was that going to Mars meant something special to him, and so did being a secret agent. They couldn't erase that. It's not a memory, but a desire, undoubtedly the same one that motivated him to volunteer for the assignment in the first place."
The other technician, Keeler, said to McLean,
"What do we do? Graft a false memory pattern over the real memory? There's no telling what the results would be. He might remember some of the genuine trip, and the confusion might bring on a psychotic interlude. He'd have to hold two opposite premises in his mind simultaneously, that he went to Mars and that he didn't, that he's a genuine agent for Interplan and that he's not, that it's spurious. I think we ought to revive him without any false memory implantation and send him out of here. This is hot."
"Agreed," McLean said. A thought came to him. "Can you predict what he'll remember when he comes out of sedation?" "Impossible to tell," Lowe said. "He probably will have some dim, diffuse memory of his actual trip now, and he'd probably be engraved out as to its validity. He'd probably decide our programming slipped a gear tooth, and he'd remember coming here. That wouldn't be erased, unless you want it erased."
"The less we mess with this man," McLean said, "the better I like it. This is nothing for us to fool around with. We've been foolish enough to, or unlucky enough to, uncover a genuine Interplan spy who has a cover so perfect that up to now even he didn't know what he was, or rather, is."
The sooner they wash their hands of the man calling himself Douglas Quayle, the better.
"Are you going to plant packets 3 and 62 in his conapt?"
Lowe said.
"No," McLean said. "And we're going to return half his fee."
"Half? Why half?"
McLean said lamely.
"It seems to be a good compromise."
As the cab carried him back to his conapt at the residential end of Chicago, Douglas Quayle said to himself, "It's sure good to be back on Terra." Already the month-long period on Mars had begun to waver in his memory. He had only an image of profound gaping craters, an ever-present ancient erosion of hills, of vitality, of motion itself. A world of dust where little happened, where a good part of the day was spent checking and rechecking one's portable oxygen source. And then the life forms, the unassuming and modest gray-brown cacti, and mawworms. As a matter of fact, he had brought back several moribund examples of Martian fauna. He had smuggled them through customs. After all, they posed no menace. They couldn't survive in Earth's heavy atmosphere. Reaching into his coat pocket, he rummaged for the container of Martian mawworms and found an envelope instead. Lifting it out, he discovered, to his perplexity, that it contained 570 poscreds in cred bills of low denomination. "Where'd I get this?" he asked himself. "Didn't I spend every cred I had on my trip?" With the money came a slip of paper marked, "One-half fee returned, by McLean," and then the date. Today's date. "Recall," he said aloud. "Recall what, sir or madam?" the robot driver of the cab inquired respectfully.
"Do you have a phone book?" Quayle demanded.
"Certainly, sir or madam."
A slot opened. From it slid a microtape phone book for Cook County.
"It's spelled oddly," Quayle said as he leafed through the pages of the yellow section. He felt fear then, abiding fear.
"Here it is," he said. "Take me there to Recall Incorporated. I've changed my mind. I don't want to go home."
"Yes, sir or madam, as the case may be," the driver said. A moment later, the cab was zipping back in the opposite direction.
"May I make use of your phone?" he asked.
"Be my guest," the robot driver said, and presented a shiny new Emperor 3D color phone to him. He dialed his own Connaught, and after a pause found himself confronted by a miniature but chillingly realistic image of Kirsten on the small screen. "I've been to Mars," he said to her.
"You're drunk," her lips writhed scornfully, "or worse."
"Scott's truth."
"When?"
she demanded. "I don't know." He felt confused.
"A simulated trip, I think. By means of one of those artificial or extra-factual or whatever it is memory places. It didn't take."
Kirsten said witheringly,
"You are drunk."
And broke the connection at her end. He hung up then, feeling his face flush.
"Always the same tone," he said hotly to himself. "Always the retort, as if she knows everything and I know nothing. What a marriage, key Christ," he thought dismally.
A moment later, the cab stopped at the curb before a modern, very attractive little pink building, over which a shifting polychromatic neon sign read, "Recall Incorporated." The receptionist, chic and bare from the waist up, started in surprise, then gained masterful control of herself.
"Oh, hello, Mr. Quayle," she said nervously. How are you? Did you forget something?"
"The rest of my fee back," he said. More composed now, the receptionist said,
"Fee? I think you are mistaken, Mr. Quayle. You were here discussing the feasibility of an extra-factual trip for you, but," she shrugged her smooth, pale shoulders, "as I understand it, no trip was taken."
Quayle said, "I remember everything, miss. My letter to Recall Incorporated, which started this whole business off. I remember my arrival here, my visit with Mr. McLean. Then the two lab technicians taking me in tow and administering a drug to put me out." No wonder the firm had returned half his fee. The false memory of his trip to Mars hadn't taken, at least not entirely, not as he had been assured.
"Mr. Quayle," the girl said, "although you are a minor clerk, you are a good-looking man, and it spoils your features to become angry. If it would make you feel any better, I might let you take me out."
He felt furious then.
"I remember you," he said savagely. "For instance, the fact that your breasts are sprayed blue, that stuck in my mind. And I remember Mr. McLean's promise that if I remembered my visit to Recall Incorporated, I'd receive my money back in full. Where is Mr. McLean?"
After a delay, probably as long as they could manage, he found himself once more seated facing the imposing walnut desk, exactly as he had been an hour or so earlier in the day. "Some technique you have," Quayle said sardonically. His disappointment and resentment was enormous by now. "My so-called memory of a trip to Mars as an undercover agent for Interplan is hazy and vague and shot full of contradictions, and I clearly remember my dealings here with you people. I ought to take this to the Better Business Bureau." He was burning angry at this point. His sense of being cheated had overwhelmed him, had destroyed his customary aversion to participating in a public squabble. Looking morose, as well as cautious, McLean said,
"We capitulate, Quayle. We'll refund the balance of your fee. I fully concede the fact that we did absolutely nothing for you."
His tone was resigned. Quayle said accusingly, "You didn't even provide me with the various artifacts that you claimed would prove to me that I had been on Mars. All that song and dance you went into, it hasn't materialized into a damn thing. Not even a ticket stub, nor postcards, nor passport, nor proof of immunization shots, nor..."
"Listen, Quayle," McLean said. "Suppose I told you..."
He broke off.
"Let it go.
He pressed a button on his intercom.
Shirley, will you disburse 570 more creds in the form of a cashier's check made out to Douglas Quayle? Thank you.
He released the button, then glared at Quayle.
Presently the check appeared. The receptionist placed it before McLean and once more vanished out of sight, leaving the two men alone, still facing each other across the surface of the massive walnut desk.
"Let me give you a word of advice," McLean said as he signed the check and passed it over. "Don't discuss your recent trip to Mars with anyone."
"What trip?"
"Well, that's the thing," doggedly McLean said. "The trip you partially remember. Act as if you don't remember. Pretend it never took place. Don't ask me why. Just take my advice. It'll be better for all of us."
He had begun to perspire freely.
"Now, Mr. Quayle, I have other business, other clients to see."
He rose, showed Quayle to the door.
Quayle said as he opened the door, "A firm that turns out such bad work shouldn't have any clients at all." He shut the door behind him.
We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, by Philip K. Dick, Part 2. On the way home in the cab, Quayle pondered the wording of his letter of complaint to the Better Business Bureau, Terra Division. As soon as he could get to his typewriter, he'd get started. It was clearly his duty to warn other people away from Recall Incorporated. When he got back to his Conapt, he seated himself before his Hermes rocket portable, opened the drawers and rummaged for carbon paper, and noticed a small, familiar box. A box which he had carefully filled on Mars with Martian fauna and later smuggled through customs. Opening the box, he saw, to his disbelief, 6 dead maw worms and several varieties of the unicellular life on which the Martian worms fed. The protozoa were dried up, dusty, but he recognized them. It had taken him an entire day picking among the vast, dark alien boulders to find them. A wonderful, illuminated journey of discovery.
"But I didn't go to Mars," he realized.
"Yet,
on the other hand..."
Kirsten appeared at the doorway to the room, an armload of pale brown groceries gripped. "Why are you home in the middle of the day?"
Her voice, in an eternity of sameness, was accusing.
"Did I go to Mars?"
he asked her.
"You would know."
"No, of course you didn't go to Mars. You would know that, I would think. Aren't you always bleating about going?"
He said, "By God, I think I went." After a pause, he added,
"And simultaneously, I think I didn't go." "Make up your mind."
"How can I?" he gestured. "I have both memory tracks grafted inside my head. One is real and one isn't. But I can't tell which is which. Why can't I rely on you? They haven't tinkered with you."
She could do this much for him at least, even if she never did anything else. Kirsten said in a level, controlled voice,
"Doug, if you don't pull yourself together, we're through. I'm going to leave you."
"I'm in trouble."
His voice came out husky and coarse and shaking.
"Probably I'm heading into a psychotic episode. I hope not, but maybe that's it. It would explain everything, anyhow."
Setting down the bag of groceries, Kirsten stalked to the closet.
"I was not kidding," she said to him quietly.
She brought out a coat, got it on, walked back to the door of the Conapt.
"I'll phone you one of these days soon," she said tonelessly. "This is goodbye, Doug. I hope you pull out of this eventually. I really pray you do, for your sake.
Wait, he said desperately. Just tell me and make it absolute. I did go or I didn't. Tell me which one. But they may have altered your memory track also, he realized.
The door closed. His wife had left. Finally. A voice behind him said, Well, that's that. Now put up your hands, Quail, and also please turn around and face this way.
He turned instinctively without raising his hands. The man who faced him wore the plum uniform of the Interplan Police Agency, and his gun appeared to be UN issue. And for some odd reason, he seemed familiar to Quail. Familiar, in a blurred, distorted fashion which he could not pin down. So, jerkily, he raised his hands.
"You remember," the policeman said, "your trip to Mars. We know all your actions today and all your thoughts, in particular your very important thoughts on the trip home from Recall Incorporated." He explained, "We have a teletransmitter wired within your skull. It keeps us constantly informed."
A telepathic transmitter. Use of a living plasma that had been discovered on Luna. He shuddered with self-aversion. The thing lived inside him, within his own brain, feeding, listening, feeding.
But the Interplan police used them. That had come out even in the homeopapes. So this was probably true, dismal as it was.
Why me? Quail said huskily. What had he done? Or thought? And what did this have to do with Recall Incorporated?
Fundamentally, the Interplan cop said, this has nothing to do with Recall. It's between you and us. He tapped his right ear. I'm still picking up your mentational processes by way of your cephalic transmitter.
In the man's ear, Quail saw a small white plastic plug.
So I have to warn you. Anything you think may be held against you, he smiled. Not that it matters now. You've already thought and spoken yourself into oblivion. What's annoying is the fact that under Narcadrine at Recall Incorporated, you told them, their technicians, and the owner, Mr. McLean, about your trip. Where you went, for whom, some of what you did. They're very frightened. They wish they had never laid eyes on you, he added reflectively. They're right.
Quail said, I never made any trip. It's a false memory chain improperly planted in me by McLean technicians.
But then he thought of the box in his desk drawer containing the Martian life forms and the trouble and hardship he had had gathering them. The memory seemed real. And the box of life forms, that certainly was real. Unless McLean had planted it. Perhaps this was one of the proofs which McLean had talked glibly about.
The memory of my trip to Mars, he thought, doesn't convince me. But unfortunately, it has convinced the Interplan Police Agency. They think I really went to Mars. And they think I at least partially realize it.
We not only know you went to Mars, the Interplan cop agreed, in answer to his thoughts, but we know that you now remember enough to be difficult for us. And there's no use expunging your conscious memory of all this, because if we do, you'll simply show up at Recall Incorporated again and start over. And we can't do anything about McLean and his operation because we have no jurisdiction over anyone except our own people. Anyhow, McLean hasn't committed any crime. He eyed Quail. Nor, technically, have you. You didn't go to Recall Incorporated with the idea of regaining your memory. You went, as we realize, for the usual reason people go there, a love by plain, dull people for adventure. He added, unfortunately, you're not plain, not dull. and you've already had too much excitement. The last thing in the universe you needed was a course from Recall Incorporated. Nothing could have been more lethal for you, or for us. And for that matter, for McLean.
Quayle said, "Why is it difficult for you if I remember my trip, my alleged trip, and what I did there?"
"Because," the Interplan Harness Bull said, "what you did is not in accord with our great, white, all-protecting father public image. You did, for us, what we never do. As you'll presently remember, thanks to Narcadrine." "That box of dead worms and algae has been sitting in your desk drawer for 6 months, ever since you got back, and at no time have you shown the slightest curiosity about it. We didn't even know you had it until you remembered it on your way home from Recall. Then we came here on the double to look for it," he added unnecessarily. "Without any luck. There wasn't enough time." A second Interplan cop joined the first one. The two briefly conferred. Meanwhile, Quayle thought rapidly. He did remember more now. The cop had been right about Narcadrine. They, Interplan, probably used it themselves. Probably? He knew darn well they did. He had seen them putting a prisoner on it. Where would that be? Somewhere on Terra? More likely on Luna, he decided, viewing the image rising from his highly defective but rapidly less so memory. And he remembered something else. Their reason for sending him to Mars. The job he had done. No wonder they had expunged his memory. "Oh, God," the first of the two Interplan cops said, breaking off his conversation with his companion. Obviously, he had picked up Quayle's thoughts. "Well, this is a far worse problem now. As bad as it can get." He walked toward Quayle, again covering him with his gun. "We've got to kill you," he said. "And right away." Nervously, his fellow officer said,
"Why right away? Can't we simply cart him off to Interplan New York and let them—"
"He knows why it has to be right away," the first cop said. He too looked nervous now. But Quayle realized that it was for an entirely different reason. His memory had been brought back almost entirely now, and he fully understood the officer's tension. "On Mars," Quayle said hoarsely, "I killed a man. After getting past 15 bodyguards, some armed with Sneaky Pete guns the way you are." He had been trained by Interplan over a 5-year period to be an assassin. A professional killer. He knew ways to take out armed adversaries, such as these two officers, and the one with the ear receiver knew it too. If he moved swiftly enough. The gun fired, but he had already moved to one side, and at the same time he chopped down the gun-carrying officer. In an instant he had possession of the gun and was covering the other confused officer. "Picked my thoughts up," Quayle said, panting for breath. "He knew what I was going to do, but I did it anyhow." Half sitting up, the injured officer grated, "He won't use that gun on you, Sam. I picked that up, too. He knows he's finished, and he knows we know it, too. Come on, Quayle." Laboriously, grunting with pain, he got shakily to his feet. He held out his hand. "The gun," he said to Quayle. "You can't use it. And if you turn it over to me, I'll guarantee not to kill you. You'll be given a hearing, and someone higher up in Interplan will decide, not me. Maybe they can erase your memory once more, I don't know. But you know the thing I was going to kill you for. I couldn't keep you from remembering it. So my reason for wanting to kill you is, in a sense, past." Quayle, clutching the gun, bolted from the Connapt, sprinted for the elevator. "If you follow me," he thought, "I'll kill you, so don't." He jabbed at the elevator button, and a moment later the door slid back. The police hadn't followed him.
Obviously, they had picked up his terse, tense thoughts and had decided not to take the chance. With him inside, the elevator descended. He had gotten away for a time. But what next? Where could he go? The elevator reached the ground floor. A moment later, Quayle had joined the mob of peds hurrying along the runnels. His head ached, and he felt sick. But at least he had evaded death. They had come very close to shooting him on the spot, back in his own Connaught.
And they probably will again, he decided, when they find me. And with this transmitter inside me, that won't take too long.
Ironically, he had gotten exactly what he had asked Recall Incorporated for. Adventure, peril, Interplan police at work, a secret and dangerous trip to Mars in which his life was at stake, everything he had wanted as a false memory. The advantages of it being a memory and nothing more could now be appreciated. On a park bench, alone, he sat dully watching a flock of perts, a semi-bird imported from Mars' two moons, capable of soaring flight, even against Earth's huge gravity.
Maybe I can find my way back to Mars, he pondered.
But then what? It would be worse on Mars. The political organization whose leader he had assassinated would spot him the moment he stepped from the ship. He would have Interplan and them after him there.
Can you hear me thinking? He wondered.
Easy avenue to paranoia. Sitting here alone, he felt them tuning in on him, monitoring, recording, discussing. He shivered, rose to his feet, walked aimlessly, his hands deep in his pockets.
No matter where I go, he realized, you'll always be with me, as long as I have this device inside my head. I'll make a deal with you, he thought to himself, and to them. Can you imprint a false memory template on me again, as you did before, that I lived an average, routine life, never went to Mars, never saw an Interplan uniform up close, and never handled a gun?
A voice inside his brain answered, as has been carefully explained to you, that would not be enough.
Astonished, he halted.
We formerly communicated with you in this manner, the voice continued, when you were operating in the field, on Mars. It's been months since we've done it. We assumed, in fact, that we'd never have to do so again. Where are you?
Walking, Quayle said. To my death. By your officers' guns, he added as an afterthought. How can you be sure it wouldn't be enough? He demanded. Don't the recall techniques work?
As we said, if you're given a set of standard average memories, you get restless. You'd inevitably seek out recall or one of its competitors again. We can't go through this a second time.
Suppose, Quayle said, once my authentic memories have been canceled, something more vital than standard memories are implanted. Something which would act to satisfy my craving, he said. That's been proved. That's probably why you initially hired me. But you ought to be able to come up with something else, something equal. I was the richest man on Terra, but I finally gave all my money to educational foundations. Or I was a famous deep space explorer. Anything of that sort. Wouldn't one of those do?
Silence.
Try it, he said desperately. Get some of your top-notch military psychiatrists. Explore my mind. Find out what my most expansive daydream is.
He tried to think.
Women, he said. Thousands of them, like Don Juan had. An interplanetary playboy, a mistress in every city on Earth, Luna and Mars. Only I gave that up, out of exhaustion. Please, he begged. Try it.
You'd voluntarily surrender, then?
the voice inside his head asked. If we agreed to arrange such a solution, if it's possible? After an interval of hesitation, he said, Yes.
I'll take the risk, he said to himself, that you don't simply kill me.
You make the first move, the voice said presently. Turn yourself over to us, and we'll investigate that line of possibility. If we can't do it, however, if your authentic memories begin to crop up again as they've done it this time, then... There was silence, and then the voice finished. We'll have to destroy you, as you must understand. Well, Quail, you still want to try?
Yes, he said, because the alternative was death now, and for certain. At least this way he had a chance, slim as it was.
You present yourself at our main barracks in New York, the voice of the Interplan cop resumed. At 580 Fifth Avenue, floor 12. Once you've surrendered yourself, we'll have our psychiatrist begin on you. We'll have personality profile tests made. We'll attempt to determine your absolute, ultimate fantasy wish. Then we'll bring you back to Recall Incorporated here. Get them in on it, fulfilling that wish in vicarious, surrogate retrospection. And good luck. We do owe you something. You acted as a capable instrument for us. The voice lacked malice. If anything, they, the organization, felt sympathy toward him. Thanks, Quail said, and began searching for a robot cab.
Mr. Quail, the stern-faced, elderly Interplan psychiatrist said, you possess a most interesting wish-fulfillment dream fantasy. Probably nothing such as you consciously entertain or suppose. This is commonly the way. I hope it won't upset you too much to hear about it.
The senior-ranking Interplan officer present said briskly, He better not be too much upset to hear about it, not if he expects not to get shot.
Unlike the fantasy of wanting to be an Interplan undercover agent, the psychiatrist continued, which, being relatively speaking a product of maturity, had a certain plausibility to it, this production is a grotesque dream of your childhood. It is no wonder you fail to recall it. Your fantasy is this. You are 9 years old, walking alone down a rustic lane. An unfamiliar variety of space vessel from another star system lands directly in front of you. No one on Earth but you, Mr. Quail, sees it. The creatures within are very small and helpless, somewhat on the order of field mice, although they are attempting to invade Earth. Tens of thousands of other ships will soon be on their way when this advance party gives the go-ahead signal.
And I suppose I stop them, Quail said, experiencing a mixture of amusement and disgust. Single-handed, I wipe them out, probably by stepping on them with my foot.
No, the psychiatrist said patiently. You halt the invasion, but not by destroying them. Instead, you show them kindness and mercy, even though by telepathy, their mode of communication, you know why they have come. They have never seen such humane traits exhibited by any sentient organism, and to show their appreciation, they make a covenant with you.
Quail said, They won't invade Earth as long as I'm alive?
Exactly. To the Interplan officer, the psychiatrist said, You can see it does fit his personality, despite his feigned scorn.
So by merely existing, Quail said, feeling a growing pleasure, by simply being alive, I keep Earth safe from alien rule?
I'm in effect, then, the most important person on Terra, without lifting a finger?
Yes, indeed, sir, the psychiatrist said. And this is bedrock in your psyche. This is a lifelong childhood fantasy, which, without depth and drug therapy, you never would have recalled. But it has always existed in you. It went underneath, but never ceased.
To McLean, who sat intently listening, the senior police official said, "Can you implant an extra-factual memory pattern that extreme in him?"
"We get handed every possible type of wish fantasy there is," McLean said. "Frankly, I've heard a lot worse than this." "Certainly we can handle it. 24 hours from now, he won't just wish he'd saved Earth. He'll devoutly believe it really happened."
The senior police official said, "You can start the job, then. In preparation, we've already once again erased the memory in him of his trip to Mars." Quayle said, "What trip to Mars?" No one answered him, so reluctantly he shelved the question. And anyhow, a police vehicle had now put in its appearance. He, McLean, and the senior police officer crowded into it, and presently they were on their way to Chicago and Recall Incorporated. "You had better make no errors this time," the police officer said to heavy-set, nervous-looking McLean.
"I can't see what could go wrong," McLean mumbled, perspiring. "This has nothing to do with Mars or Interplan. Single-handedly stopping an invasion of Earth from another star system." He shook his head at that. "Wow, what a kid dreams up. And by pious virtue, too, not by force. It's sort of quaint."
He dabbed at his forehead with a large linen pocket handkerchief. Nobody said anything.
"In fact," McLean said, "it's touching."
"But arrogant," the police official said starkly. "Inasmuch as when he dies, the invasion will resume." "No wonder he doesn't recall it. It's the most grandiose fantasy I ever ran across." He eyed Quayle with disapproval. "And to think we put this man on our payroll." When they reached Recall Incorporated, the receptionist, Shirley, met them breathlessly in the outer office.
"Welcome back, Mr. Quayle," she fluttered, her melon-shaped breasts, today painted an incandescent orange, bobbing with agitation. "I'm sorry everything worked out so badly before. I'm sure this time it'll go better."
Still repeatedly dabbing at his shiny forehead with his neatly folded Irish linen handkerchief, McLean said,
"It better."
Moving with rapidity, he rounded up Lowe and Keeler, escorted them and Douglas Quayle to the work area, and then, with Shirley and the senior police officer, returned to his familiar office to wait.
"Do we have a packet made up for this, Mr. McLean?"
Shirley asked, bumping against him in her agitation, then coloring modestly.
"I think we do,"
he tried to recall, then gave up and consulted the formal chart.
"A combination," he decided aloud, "of packets 81, 20, and 6.
From the vault section of the chamber behind his desk, he fished out the appropriate packets, carried them to his desk for inspection.
"From 81, he explained, "a magic healing rod given him, the client in question, this time Mr. Quayle, by the race of beings from another system, a token of their gratitude."
"Does it work?" the police officer asked curiously.
"It did once," McLean explained. "But he, you see, used it up years ago, healing right and left. Now it's only a memento, but he remembers it working spectacularly."
He chuckled, then opened packet 20.
"Document from the UN Secretary General thanking him for saving Earth.
This isn't precisely appropriate, because part of Quail's fantasy is that no one knows of the invasion except himself, but for the sake of verisimilitude, we'll throw it in.
He inspected Packet 6, then. What came from this? He couldn't recall, frowning. He dug into the plastic bag as Shirley and the Interplan police officer watched intently.
Writing, Shirley said, in a funny language.
This tells who they were, McLean said, and where they came from, including a detailed star map logging their flight here and the system of origin. Of course, it's in their script, so he can't read it. But he remembers them reading it to him in his own tongue.
He placed the three artifacts in the center of the desk.
These should be taken to Quail's Conapt, he said to the police officer, so that when he gets home, he'll find them, and it'll confirm his fantasy. S.O.P., standard operating procedure, he chuckled apprehensively, wondering how matters were going with Lowe and Keeler.
The intercom buzzed.
Mr. McLean, I'm sorry to bother you.
It was Lowe's voice. He froze as he recognized it, froze and became mute.
But something's come up. Maybe it would be better if you came in here and supervised. Like before, Quail reacted well to the narcodrine. He's unconscious, relaxed, and receptive. But...
McLean sprinted for the work area. On a hygienic bed, Douglas Quail lay breathing slow and regularly, eyes half shut, dimly conscious of those around him.
We started interrogating him, Lowe said, white-faced, to find out exactly when to place the fantasy memory of him single-handedly having saved Earth. And, strangely enough...
They told me not to tell, Douglas Quail mumbled in a dull, drug-saturated voice. That was the agreement. I wasn't even supposed to remember. But how could I forget an event like that?
I guess it would be hard, McLean reflected. But you did. Until now.
They even gave me a scroll, Quail mumbled, of gratitude. I have it hidden in my Conapt. I'll show it to you.
To the Interplan officer who had followed after him, McLean said,
Well, I offer the suggestion that you better not kill him. If you do, they'll return.
They also gave me a magic, invisible, destroying rod,
Quail mumbled, eyes totally shut now.
That's how I killed that man on Mars you sent me to take out. It's in my drawer, along with the box of Martian mawworms and dried-up plant life.
Wordlessly, the Interplan officer turned and stalked from the work area.
I might as well put those packets of proof artifacts away, McLean said to himself resignedly.
He walked, step by step, back to his office.
Including the citation from the UN Secretary General. After all...
The real one probably would not be long in coming.